Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is the week 7 of the Fisher Files, and today I'm going to be talking about electronic mail, or email. So a little bit about me. I first started using computers in 1972 on an IBM 1130, which had, I think, all of 16K of memory and about a 1 megabyte disk and a big punch card reader and a big line printer. And that was about it. As far as I know, this computer wasn't connected to anything else, and all you could really do with it is drop your stack of punch cards in and then go over to the line printer and wait for something to come out and then look at what came out and adjust your punch cards accordingly and keep doing that. I think I sent my first email in 1986, maybe 87, and that was when I was at the Paul Scherrer Institute near Zurich in Switzerland. And the way you sent email then was there was a computer account that we all shared at the computer in Zurich, and you logged into that, and even logging in from computer to computer was sort of new, and opened email and then looked in the subject headings for the mail message that was for you. And I guess it was just taken as dishonorable to look at someone else's email. So of course that's all changed, and we all use email quite heavily, and it's a wonderful tool. But one thing that we should all think about is that it's a still evolving tool. I think it took the telephone about 30 years, maybe 20 years, to emerged to the point where there was an established protocol for how you spoke on the phone and what you talked about, what you didn't talk about. And I think email is just starting this. So kind of the central message of what I'm going to say today is that you should really be giving some thought to when and where you want to use email, what kind of expectations you want to set up among your peers and colleagues about how you're going to use email, how you're going to respond to email, and how often you want to check email, and basically what you want email to do for you. So to start, how do you compose a message to someone? Many people treat email as kind of their part of a conversation, and their messages just look like a sentence that just kind of pick up where the last email they received left off, and it's just their half of a two-way conversation. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with doing that, as long as the person on the other end is aware that that's what you're doing. For myself, I tend to be a little bit formal about email, and I really think of electronic mail as a electronic replacement for snail mail. So when I send a message, it's really like a little letter. It's got a salutation, and then a body, and then a closing. And I also think it's wise to be pretty careful about what you put in email. In our society, it's really not done to show a third party a personal letter. We don't get many personal letters anymore, but certainly the notion of distributing a personal letter by Xeroxing it and giving copies to people is, I think, really considered by outside the pale, at least by those of us who still write personal letters. Email, on the other hand, is completely different. An email message can be forwarded to anybody. It can be printed out on a laser printer and not collected and read by anyone with access to that laser printer. I think a good rule of thumb is don't put anything in an email that's so sensitive that it would be devastating to have the wrong person read it. And that should really condition what you put in email. Sort of a corollary to that is that if you get an email that makes you very angry, rather than typing a very sharp response to it, I would consider calling the person on the phone and sorting it out over the phone or in person. Many times I've seen emails, and since most email programs these days, when you reply, attaches your reply to the previous message, you know, appropriately offset so that you know that it was the message you're responding to. And you can see the hostility ratchet up across 10 or 12 email messages. And very frequently, this is a simple misunderstanding. But I think universally, these things are much things that are much better taken care of in person. So this is certainly an area where email is still evolving. Another thing you should really give some consideration to is what kind of information should be passed via email. I recently wrote a letter as part of a promotion case at Harvard, and I sent the PDF by email, and I also sent the hard copy by snail mail. But I think 5 years ago it would have been just unthinkable to have something so important sent by email. But now funding decisions, admissions to universities and graduate programs, major purchases are these days done entirely by email. And so it's an area that's really changing. But you should think carefully about what kind of message you want to send via email. I mean, certainly, were I going through the tenure process now, I would not want to have the outcome of that process communicated to me by email. I simply think it's inappropriate. So it's a good place to give some thought to what you want to send by email. Another thing to really sort of think through carefully is how you want, how frequently you're going to check your email. There are people who arrange things sort of 15 minutes in advance by email on the assumption that the people they're arranging with look at their email that frequently. That's fine. But some of us, myself for example, really try to keep a lid on the email and only check it a few times a day. And so you want to really be aware that there's a large diversity of opinion for how often someone's going to check their email. I think as a rule of thumb, unless you know the person pretty well, it's probably wise to assume that if you send someone an email message, that they will look at it sometime during the day they get it and will perhaps respond the next day. I know I leave a lot of the email work for at home in the evening when it's hard to do other things. So kind of the big message about email is give a lot of thought to what your expectations are and what your colleagues' expectations are, and hopefully that will avoid a lot of the wasted time that can follow on email confusion. Now, email itself has gotten quite sophisticated and I think actually very interesting. Of course, you have your inbox where incoming messages are, and I think it's a really good idea to go through your whole inbox every day and sort out all of those email messages. If they're actionable, they should go into buckets. If they're something that you want to save for future reference, they should go into a folder. If it's something you just read and make it into a to-do or something like that, and then delete, they should just be deleted. But I think a really good feeling for me is to end the day with no email messages in the inbox. Now, the whole idea of folders is something that's changing a lot because the new utilities like Entourage and Mail App on the Macintosh have things like Spotlight that catalog everything in every email message and allow you to search messages very, very quickly, either by sender, receiver, keywords in the subject or in the body. And this really means that the old paradigm of having a bunch of different folders for different topics and sorting your email into those folders is something that's going away. And you can just have one folder, saved messages, and use Spotlight to find email when you need it. I'm not saying that's the best thing to do, but think about it. It's certainly less confusing and troublesome than having a zillion folders. And I find myself just using Spotlight all the time anyway, for both email and on my hard disk. One thing you do want to do is use IMAP and have your email stored centrally, either on Athena at MIT or Gmail or someplace where it's backed up and secure. Email has gotten so important that losing all of it because you drop your laptop or leave your laptop on an airplane can potentially cause you a lot of trouble. Now, if you think about it, your email program is actually a pretty sophisticated thing and can be used for a lot of things besides email. As I've mentioned before, both Mail on the Macintosh and Entourage and probably most sort of high-end email programs have context searching and the ability to store things in folders and then sort those things inside the folder by date or size or subject or sender and perform keyword searches on all of those things, some of which are quite sophisticated. So if you choose, you could certainly use your email program, for example, to maintain to-do lists. Typically, email programs allow for several different file structures, so you could set up one for real email that would access your IMAP account, and you could set up the other another account which didn't access any real account but just served as a repository for a series of folders that would be to-do lists that you could click open, and the date would correspond to the date you entered the to-do, and then you'd actually have a pretty powerful tool, not just for storing things to do, but being able to attach files and graphics and all kinds of things to each message. Another thing you could do is, most of us keep notebooks of one form or another, and mine's just a physical laboratory notebook that I scribble things in, and you know, sometimes I forget it, leave it lying around places. One thing which I actually heard from Janet Conrad is that you can simply set up your a part of your mail file structure, folder structure, as a electronic notebook. And again, you have the powerful opportunity to be able to store text files and PDFs and all kinds of any kind of attachment that you could normally attach to. An email message could be stored inside the mail program. All of this has the additional advantages that it makes it very easy to send this stuff around whenever you want to, if you need to share it. Another major advantage of using mail in this way is that it's immediately accessible from any computer if you have things set up so that you can use a program like MIT's Webmail. And then you don't have to rely on having your notebook or your to-do list synchronize between several different computers. So the mail program actually can do a lot more than mail. Even something that's, you know, pretty crappy like Pine could handle a lot of the things that I've just described. So to sort of summarize the talk about email, it's an absolutely crucial thing, and you're well worth spending some time learning how to configure your program and setting up files and folders so that it makes sense. Remember also to give some thought about what you're going to say when you use email and how you're going to say it to prevent fights or you know, prevent yourself from having problems due to misunderstanding. And also give some thought to how you want to use email. Are you going to use it as a replacement for your telephone so that you're going to be looking at it more or less constantly and able to arrange things on a 15-minute notice via email? Or are you going to use it more like snail mail and have it be something you just check once or twice a day, or something in between? I just want to emphasize I'm not advocating any particular point of view. What I am advocating is a little bit of thought so that you use it consistently and avoid time and distraction when you don't use it consistently. Another thing I'm just starting to use on my computers is AOL Instant Messaging. I have a few hard-to-reach friends, a couple of whom are at CERN, and that's really the only way I can reach them. As you know, instant messaging is more or less immediate. A window pops up on your screen, and if they're sitting looking at their computer, which of course they always are, they'll immediately see your message. And you can carry on a fairly primitive conversation back and forth, or use that to arrange a phone call. I haven't really come down on how useful this is for me. It is another thing on the desktop, another thing to look at, and for me adding something like that is a pretty big deal. So my bet is that I don't wind up using it except in really specific instances. But it is there, it's free. You can download it from AIM.com, which is America Online Instant Messaging. And it works on just about any computer. Of course, there's the MIT Zephyr program, which I guess maybe is gone now, but that used to be extremely useful, I found, for communicating with students. However, this utility has to be balanced with the fact that, you know, it's yet another thing to worry about. So that's it for email this week. Just keep in mind the big picture here is that it's one of the biggest time sinks in your day, and a little thoughtfulness can at least reduce the burden on you as far as sorting messages. For this week's Mind Feed, there are a few interesting things that came up. One is a physical review letter about modified Newtonian dynamics. Modified Newtonian dynamics attempts to get rid of dark matter by altering the gravitational 1 over r squared force law. And this article does some simple analysis that indicates that during two points in the year, there are times when, on Earth, when modified Newtonian mechanics would be observable. Modified Newtonian dynamics would be observable on Earth in the laboratory. Mostly, MOND, as it's called, is astrophysical, and but there are certain times during the year, during the solstices, when the Earth is in just the right position so that one could observe an anomalous acceleration. Now, most of the astrophysicists I've talked to really think Mond is junk, and well, because they're fairly smart guys, I really sort of tend to agree with them. But it is worth paying a little bit of attention to this. The bullet galaxies really didn't kill Mond. So it's something I still look at from time to time. There was another interesting report in Nature in the Research Highlights section, and it's a article in Europhysics Letters about reversal of the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field reverses about every 100,000 years, and that's because it's created by a dynamo in the molten Earth's core. And the dynamo, which is threaded with a magnetic field, undergoes a reversal just because of the very complex dynamics taking place there, which, as far as I know, are not really very well understood. The field reverses, reversals take 5 or 10,000 years, and during this time, the Earth is not very well protected by the magnetic field, and consequently loses a large fraction of its atmosphere, and everybody gets fried by cosmic rays for a little while. Now, it's been about 300,000 years since the last field reversal, and consequently one is happening now. And there's actually a region of the Earth, the South Atlantic Anomaly, where the magnetic field is much weaker than it is in most other places, and that's a feature of this reversal. Anyway, there's a report that a French group, which has actually set up a kind of a spinning sphere of liquid sodium in a magnetic field, so they just kind of built a model Earth, have got it spinning around and have written a paper claiming that they are able to reduce this field reversal in liquid sodium. Yeah, this thing is a couple of meters across. So that's really kind of an interesting thing that this is now a little bit more well understood. There's another article in Nature about D-Wave, which is this company in Canada that claims to make the world's first quantum computer. The quantum computer in question works by adiabatic transformations, something pioneered by Eddie Fari at MIT. And the controversy is whether or not this thing is actually a quantum computer. They haven't published anything about the details of how their thing works. They're just selling this computer, and I guess you can buy one and read the manual and figure out how it works. But there's some serious controversy over A, how useful it is, and B, is it actually a quantum computer. So I'm going to talk to Scott Sewell about getting one for Junior Lab. There's also a number of interesting articles in this month's Nature about quantum optics, about the ability to query a cavity for the presence or absence of one photon using an atomic beam. This stuff just gets more interesting every time I look at it, and I'm actually at a loss of to explain how this experiment actually works. So I'm going to post the paper in the program notes and see if one of you can explain it to me. Finally, you know, the schmucks at NASA are still at it with their stepping back from American science. As you may have heard, NASA's big new mission is to go to the moon and then to Mars, which are fine things to do. But they've really, really cut down on science to be able to do this. And just last week there was an article in Science saying the experiment I worked on for a long time, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, will not go to the space station. And this is just sad. They made a commitment, and I understand there are technical reasons they feel they can't meet it, but they really have to get their act together. When you think about it, in the last 10 years, with the new cosmology, NASA has played an absolutely key role in that with first COBE and then WMAP, and support for other spacecraft, and in the future, continued support, well, certainly in the past, support of Hubble for the deep redshift supernova, and future support for X-ray missions and SNAP and a future large telescope are very important. And in this time when Nobel Prizes are being given for this work, NASA steps back from it. It really shows that something's wrong. I mean, this is something that's really bearing fruit now. It's the hot thing. It's the greatest revolution since Newton. And somehow they just don't seem to have the political wherewithal to be able to support it. And, yeah, that says something.
Okay, this sounds cool. Here I am.
So that's it for this week. Next week we'll be talking about filing things and generally keeping track of things, and the emphasis won't be on being neat, but the emphasis will be being able to put your hands on things quickly. I want to apologize for the kind of lousy sound in the last two podcasts. I had this wonderful little adapter for my iPod so that I could just yap into a stereo speaker or a stereo microphone. And on my trip, I managed to lose that. And I can't get my stereo microphone to work with my MacBook for reasons that elude me. And so now I just have to use the built-in microphone, which means I just sit staring at the computer talking instead of my usual reclining position. So anyway, sorry about that. We'll get it fixed for the next podcast. I'd like to thank Sheila Holzer and her husband John Marston, and Maynard Galinas and Sean Thompson, the LNS Computational Facility, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed at REFS. And I'd like to put in a plug for REFS. They did just a terrific job at the faculty lunch last week where they talked about REFS, which stands for Resources for Easing Friction and Stress. And so any of you who are students who are stressed out about something, if your advisor is treating you badly, you could go talk to them and they'll help you sort things out. You should do that unless I'm your advisor. And then if I'm your advisor, you're not being treated badly. You're treating wonderfully and you have nothing to complain about. So that said, have a good week. Enjoy your research and enjoy your work. Yeah, in Cambridge or wherever you are.
I'm giving out.
Thanks so much for Everyday Jones. If you want to buy a CD.